We're in the Royal Society in London. It's actually the day after the new Prime Minister has been elected, David Cameron, which is why there's a helicopter hovering outside, just in case you're wondering about the background noise. And we're with Anthony Grayling, Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck College, one of England's leading public intellectuals, and the author of a new book, yet another new book, you're prolific, called Ideas That Matter. Welcome. Good to see you again. We last spoke at Beyond Belief, at the Salk Institute, and we did a kind of a personal background on you. So I want to just get some sense of sort of going into some specifics on a few new areas. And one of them is, as I arrived in this country and went to the bookstore, as I always do, these magazines are out there, brand new. Philosophy Now, Is God Really Dead? This is a reference to an old Time magazine cover which said, Is God Dead? Which obviously is a Nietzsche reference. And Standpoint, The Man Delusion. Melanie Phillips says, We've lost touch with God and reason. So, the Philosopher's Magazine, Beyond the New Atheism, The Next Stage in the God Debate. You know, I thought we'd kind of done this in 2006, 7, 8 in our Beyond Belief meetings. Plainly not. Plainly, it's still a very incendiary subject. Hasn't gone away. Can I get your thoughts on that?
Yes, the quarrel, which is a rather acerbic one between people who are on the side of religion, whether they're themselves committed to a particular faith or they're sort of fellow travellers, and there are a number of them around because, you know, there's a long tradition of thought which says that religions, even if false, nevertheless scoop up aspects of the yearning, the spiritual needs of people, and also help to keep them under control somewhat, which was an important reason why ecclesiastical authorities and temporal authorities have so often been in one another's pockets during history. So the quarrel between them and the people who don't have religion and who are even hostile towards the effect that religious attitudes and religious practices have on societies all around the world. This quarrel is a very, very acerbic one, and it's not going to die down anytime soon. It's going to rumble on, and you've just given us the evidence. We all thought that we had finished the argument and could move on to something else, but it is going to rumble on, and the reason for it is either, and this is the analysis that some people give, that religion is resurgent and that it's finding its feet, it's finding its voice in a way that it didn't need to up until fairly recently, a decade or two ago, because there was a general consensus, or, well, you know, they've got faith, let's respect that and let them get on with it. Or if you take the alternative analysis, which is mine, that religion is doing this because it's on the back foot. It's under threat. It's like a cornered animal. What has happened is that numbers are not increasing, numbers of observers of religion are not increasing, but the volume, the amplification of their voice is. There are some empirical bits of evidence that back this up. In the United States of America, one of the most religious countries in the world, the proportion of people who, when they're polled by the Pew organization, who say that they don't have a religious affiliation, who are agnostic or atheist or secularist, has been increasing by leaps and bounds. In fact, it's doubled in the last couple of decades. And the increase in the number of people who don't have a religious commitment in the United States among young people, people up under the age of 35, is the largest increase and the most significant one, because that tells us something about the future. The world is a secularizing planet, and there are a lot of people who don't like that, and that is the reason why that there is such a noise about it. There's an historical precedent for this, which is the 16th and 17th century. When the Church of Rome lost its grip on the mind of Europe and on the tithes of Europe, it fought back very hard. The wars of religion in France in the 16th century and the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, which was the greatest, the bloodiest, the most destructive war that Europe had ever experienced, was in very large part, not exclusively, but in large part, prompted by the endeavor of the church to regain its hegemony over Europe. But in fact, it was on the back foot, it was failing, it was diminishing, it was losing influence, but it took a very bloody struggle to get its fingers off those levers, and I think we're seeing something similar now.
Now, interestingly enough, you mentioned 17th century. We're obviously sitting in the Royal Society, 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society, which was just following, I mean, Charles II has just come back. We're just following civil war in England with immense religious connotations underpinning that. But as we move here 350 years on, one of the things I do see is there's a lot more, and correct me if I'm wrong in my interpretation here, a number of scientists actually coming out and saying, oh, let's not have these unsightly quarrels. I mean, let's let the people go to church, stained glass windows, very nice, music, very nice. Nothing to worry about here. In larger numbers, in opposition to what has been called the new atheists, you know, Richard Dawkins, Chris Hitchens, Sam Harris. I don't know if you include yourself into that group or not, but so why the sudden ameliorating posture on the on the part of a number of scientists?
Well, in a way, this is predictable because in the rhetorical character of the debate has been such that after the 9/11 atrocities in the United States and after the 7th of July 2005 atrocity in London and the Madrid atrocities, you know, these suicide bombings and mass murders of people for reasons to do with Islamic fundamentalism mainly, of course, happen in the Islamic world, in the Middle East and elsewhere. They are the greatest sufferers of their own turmoil. But when these things happen in the West, in the way that they have done, they've woken people up with a shock to the fact that the religiously inspired or justified violence, which, of course, in terms of numbers of people actually harmed, not numbers of people terrified by, but numbers of people harmed by, is tiny in comparison to the numbers of people killed and maimed in the conflicts that are going on in the world today, in part generated by this. But nevertheless, they have an incredibly powerful psychological effect, which is we thought that we in the West had gone beyond that, that we had come to a kind of settlement, that the settlement, in fact, the 1648 Westphalian settlement, which said let every country have its own religion and the you know, be perhaps the religion of the ruler, or but at any rate, let's accept pluralism, let's accept diversity, let's accept that there are different points of view, and let's stop anyone trying to impose their point of view on other people, a kind of latitudinarian view. But the shock that people have felt in the West is that in the name of religion, these atrocities can still be committed. There are people who will still kill and die. You know, they say, my faith is what I die for, dogma is what I kill for. You know, that there are still people motivated by that. And it has shed light on a number of important facts about this point in history. This point in history, you know, has a number of strands running into it. Well, we all think that our own time in history is the most important or dangerous or something, but there is something crucial about this time, which is this, that the Enlightenment project, which is a project of pluralism, of democracy, of the application of considered reason and empiricism to the affairs of mankind in general, that is importing and diffusing the scientific method, the rational empirical method, to thinking about how to organize society, to giving individuals a great margin of autonomy to think about how they can construct good lives themselves. That's the Enlightenment project. It's a kind of idealization of what many of the people in the historical Enlightenment in the 18th century would like to have seen. This is why they spoke in terms of rights, they spoke in terms of getting rid of those absolutisms of church and state which owned human beings, that human beings were going to own themselves from here on, and that it was an important part of that they should be equipped and educated and rational, know things about the world. So if you take this idealization of what the Enlightenment was about and you apply it to modern times, that is 19th and 20th centuries, now in 21st century, you see that the idea there is, let us be very pluralistic, let us respect the rights and autonomy of individuals, let us base what we do on the pragmatic, empirical, reasoned, experienced attitude to things in society, in education, in public policy matters, just as we do in science. Let's try to use that kind of mindset to work our way through problems in the world in general. That's the Enlightenment project, which is involved, of course, with the advance itself of science and of technology and the uses of technology. And the great problem is that the public understanding of science and the public understanding of technology and why it works and what it does and what it can do and the extent to which it can change things for us has diverged and diverged more rapidly, even since 1959 when C.P. Snow talked about the two cultures and the danger of a widening gap. That gap has widened even further. A lot of people are made nervous by science and the, its potentials. A lot of people are less sure now that science can come up with the fixes that people, you know, back in the 50s and 60s thought that science could solve the demographic problem, the food problem, the pollution problem. People are not so sure anymore. So they don't understand it, they're more skeptical of it. And it is a natural human desire to have a neat story that makes sense of the world, gives them a framework for thinking. And so they can turn, if not to the traditional religions, because not many people are, but to all sorts of things, crystals and feng shui, and, you know, almost anything which is relatively simple to understand, it can be explained in 10 minutes, because it doesn't take 10 minutes to explain physics, it takes, you know, 5 years to really get to the bottom of it. And so we've got a problem of intellectual culture, which is one where this widening gap, plus traditional religionists feel very, very threatened by the apparently remorseless juggernaut of the secularizing, science-minded approach to everything in the world. I mean, you could take an example. Think of a traditional Muslim father in a Middle Eastern country with daughters, teenage daughters, who sees an American movie, lots of girls running around in bikinis, or perhaps not even that. And he's terrified for his daughters and for their way of life. And so he's made afraid. And his fear fuels the anger of other people who have even more contact than he does with the West, with Muslims who live in the West or Muslims who are educated in the West and who are on the very radical extreme wing of Islam and who feel a necessity to fight back. I mean, by the way, of course, the vast majority of Muslims, like the vast majority of human beings everywhere, just want to live in peace and quiet and get on with things and make a bit of money and so on. But, you know, there are radical wings, extreme wings everywhere, and they're the ones to worry about because they're the ones who are going to try and act on these fears and these anxieties. So they use the science and the technology that should be making us all more rational. You know, it's like watching television on a religious feast day and not recognizing that there's some contradiction between the two ways of looking at the world. But they use it in order to fight on behalf of what is ultimately a medieval way of thinking about things, medieval way of running society. And it's a paradox, it's a contradiction. It shows the cross currents, the conflicts of thought and action that we are faced with at in our time. And the one clearest point that needs to be made about how we start approaching a solution to it is to generalize a greater understanding of the scientific mindset so that people can understand why it comes up with what it does, why it says what it does about us and the world.
Number of points there, obviously. You travel a lot as well as a sort of ambassador in some sense. You've been to Bhutan and so on and various places. You deal with the World Economic Council and so on. So you're very interested in global eudaimonia, if you like, well-being, global well-being. Plainly, you must be a little distressed when you go to all these places and discover that the situation in the Middle East is just still very fraught. The position of Israel vis-a-vis Palestine is extremely explosive at this point. I come here to England and find out that it's much more pro-Palestine than you would find in the US and so on. You will be going to Copenhagen fairly shortly for an atheists meeting. You'll doubtless find that the Muslim population in Scandinavia is going up by leaps and bounds, and people are wearing t-shirts that in fact threaten to increase their population by leaps and bounds. So these don't sound like small things to be worried about, and I know a lot of people who are deeply distressed by them. So,
oh, it's serious. I mean, if one takes the view, and I think it's a minority view, perhaps I'm the only person who thinks it, that this is religion on the back foot. This is religion fighting against a remorseless, secularization in our world at large. Behind which, by the way, are the great powers of money and and of military prowess and of world diplomatic influence. So the religionists have a good deal to worry about in this respect, and really perhaps ought to be fighting a rather different battle, which is accepting a point that considered secularism always makes. Considered secularism is a view that both religious and non-religious people could sign up for. Really is the traditional view that matters of religion and matters of public policy of the state should be kept separate. And in practical terms, what this means is that religious organizations and churches and groups should recognize themselves for what they are, namely, they are self-constituted interest groups. They exist to promote the interests of whatever it is they believe in and how they think the world ought to be run. They have every right to exist, and they have every right to have their say. They've got things to put into the public conversation, and they have a right to be listened to, along with everybody else. The problem is that religious bodies, religious organizations, churches, have, for historical reasons, had a massively overinflated footprint in the public square, massively amplified voice in matters of policy and society. And it's that distortion, the fact that, in Europe, the proportion of populations in Europe would be less than 10% in any European country of people who go regularly, more than three times a month or more, to a mosque or a synagogue or a church or a cathedral or whatever. They're a tiny fraction, the really committed and active religionists in Europe. And yet, they get public funding, they get money from the government to run their own schools, to bring up people in their own faith. They get wheeled out on television programs, talk about moral panics in society. They have a massively over-amplified voice in the public square. And what the secularist project of today says is, look, you've got to downsize. You've got to downsize this noise that you make, because you don't really, you're not really as representative as you think you are. This may be different in Muslim majority countries, of course, where there is no neutral translation of the term secular. Into Arabic, for example, it comes out as something like hostile to religion. And in the United States of America, you have extremely powerful, well-funded, well-organized religious lobbies with television programs and radio stations. Unlike the 30 million or so non-religious people in the self-described non-religious people in the US, who are of course equal to one person because they're not organized. So you get this disparity. And one of our main tasks today is to try to get the religious folk to accept what they are, because historically, for traditional reasons, they've been able to, look big. They're like the Wizard of Oz, the great big castle and a big cardboard front, but really they're just little guys in underpants behind it, and they've got to recognize that that's the case.
Yeah, and you make the point in your entry on religion here. Take Christianity as an example. Stop people exiting a church after a Sunday service and ask them about the details of their faith, and one is sure to find much haziness organized around the tales that form the staple of Sunday school instruction, together concerning which bits, a wide variety of cherry pickings concerning which bits of the Bible to believe literally, which not to believe literally, and so on and so forth. So you're basically saying, we could obviously circumnavigate this one for a long time, as I was just saying, but is one of the things, let me make a connection to something else, is one of the things that you think might be stimulating this, the fact that as the baby boomer generation gets along, maybe I'm stretching a bit here, there's more people living longer, so the prospect of considering exits, death, the final moment and so on, it does seem to be more in the, again, is more in the popular press and so on. There's a lot of stuff about how to live longer, but there's also lots of articles that go along with that about death and so on, and the importance of death. And Julian Barnes just wrote a book about all these sorts of things about them. So do you think perhaps people are more contemplating their ends, as it were, and therefore perhaps scurrying off into religious directions as well? Is there any evidence for that?
I remember once when I was an undergraduate, I was going for a walk in the country with a friend, and we saw in the distance some elderly people tottering into a church. It was a Sunday morning. And my friend rather laconically said, I'm swatting for finals, he said, which I suppose is just an English way of putting
the ball. Swatting for finals.
Swatting for finals. You know, in the past, until relatively recently, and we're talking about late 19th, perhaps even mid-20th century, death was much, much more present in people's lives. Their children died, you know, the infant mortality was much higher, women died in childbirth, average life expectancy was much lower, certainly among the working classes, it might only be, you know, in the 40s. People died at home and funerals happened from home. We are now much more sanitized and healthier, wealthier Western world are not confronted with death all that often. You know, there are certain stages in life when our parents die or when we get a bit older and our friends begin to die, yes. But generally speaking, it happens in hospital. There's a mortuary that looks after things, a funeral director who deals with everything, and our contact with it is rather sanitized.
But we have more time to ponder the meaning of life.
Well, we do. But I would have thought, actually, that what people spend a lot of their mental energy doing is avoiding thinking about mortality and trying to find ways of postponing it or diminishing its effects. You're quite right to say, however, that we do have a serious problem here, which is thinking about how we deal with these longer lifespans, given that they tend to have reasonably wealthy leisure associated with them. I mean, as you know, in the last half century, the average Westerner has lived 2 years longer every decade. I mean, that's how much it's been increasing. And we're faced with the possibility of genetic medical techniques, which might dramatically alter the picture about longevity. And then we're faced with this sort of problem. Do we extend life but not conquer the diseases and frailties of aging, in which case Western populations have to support very large disabled or at any rate frail populations of elderly people? Or do we extend life and conquer the problems of aging, in which case women in their 60s and 80s might want to have another couple of children or, you know, and that creates all sorts of different social problems, because then how do you ration children? We have a really serious problem if women could keep reproducing all their lives long, because if they could, they would. I mean, after the children have grown up and everything, they might want to do it again. So you've got two different sets of problems to face here. How you manage them becomes a serious issue. And in neither case, if we do succeed in extending life and conquering the problems of aging, are we going to refocus attention on matters of end-of-life care and choices that people make about when and how they die and what death means to us, in a way that we find some people thinking and talking about very sensibly now? But not everybody does. It's a debate which needs to be extended. More people need to be informed and educated about what's at stake at the moment and what we can do and what we can't do at the end of life.
We just actually finished some conversations here with a group of people brought together by Linda Partridge and her colleagues. The meeting was called The New Science of Aging. And this question obviously came up, because if you're talking about extending healthy lifespan, there's all sorts of social issues arise from that. But there's also this notion of the end of life as well. And I think I mentioned to you this quote from Lear, which seems to sum things up, summarize things quite well, where his daughter Reagan says, "Oh, sir, you are old. Nature in you stands on the very verge of her confine. You should be ruled and led by some discretion that discerns your state better than you yourself." That sounds very much like what Sarah Palin was worrying about, death panels and people deciding when you should exit.
Yeah. Well, of course,
now you're involved with an organization that thinks about these issues, aren't you? Denial of death.
It's called
with
Dignity
death.
In Dying, yes, which used to be called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society, yeah. And its name has evolved as the public debate about these matters have evolved. Just as a bit of background, in poll after poll, year after year, decade after decade in this country, the United Kingdom, something in the region of 80% of people favor assisted dying if people who are terminally ill or who are irremediably disabled or ill wish it. It's a serious point, this, that it has to be a competent individual who has shown a settled will to be helped to die, to be helped to leave life, that they should be allowed to do so. 80% of people say this. Now, I've been involved with Dignity in Dying and sister organizations in, for example, drafting and presenting a bill to Parliament on this matter. It's been done 3 times in recent years, and each time, of course, because the bill was introduced in the House of Lords, and there's a, you know, sitting by right bishops in the House of Lords who are hostile to this, and people on the political spectrum who are anxious about the slippery slope argument that they think follows from it, the bills have been defeated. But at least they've been discussed. And there is this groundswell of public support for the idea that people, autonomously and if competent, can make choices about this matter. And this is where the Lear quote is interesting, because the assumption made there is that Lear is losing his mental competence. He's back in a second childhood. He needs to be guided or led. It's a very condescending view about older people. And the focus of the debate really has to be on competent individuals who can make these serious choices for themselves. Terry Pratchett has given a great boost to the debate here. Terry Pratchett, the fantasy and science fiction writer, who has a form of Alzheimer's disease and who wants to be helped to die when life becomes intolerable. Now, he could, because the disease is not in itself a fatal one, live for a very long time, but in a very disabled way. And he doesn't want to do that. And he talks about assisted dying, uses this phrase rather than assisted suicide or euthanasia, because it's a more general label. And I think it's a good label in a way, because it carries with it the idea that anybody who had an settled autonomous attitude to this matter should be taken seriously. Not a depressed person, because such a person might get better. Not somebody who has a disease that could be cured, because we want to give them an opportunity to seriously think again. But people who are in irremediable, unrelievable situations. Now, it happens that we already, behind the big fig leaf of trying to distinguish between active and passive euthanasia and the rest of it, and you know, not interfering, removing feeding tubes and all that, we try and hide behind the idea that we're just removing treatment and then what happens is the course of nature. But in fact, these are techniques of assisted dying. They are. We should be frank about it. And we should put it into an organized ethical and legal framework, as happens in Oregon, for example, or in the Netherlands. This is something that should happen, generally speaking, because we are, and it's an old point, but it's a true point, kinder to our pets in these respects than we are to our fellow human beings. And it's a hangover of religious anxieties about who has the right to create and bring an end to life.
I'm prompted by your statement about kinder to our pets there to move to your little section here on vegetarianism. And note that this, to my mind at least, is one of the great strengths of this book, is that you have a very wry way of putting some things. So you set out the arguments for vegetarianism, the health business and the economic argument, planetary argument, and so on. And then you go on to there's a comment here where you're talking about the filling your mouth with rotting flesh full of injected hormones and vaccines, pullulating with microbes and covered in microbe diarrhea. All these things, plus a carcinogenic finish of heat damage caused by the cooking process, add up to a tasty morsel after all. And who can deny it? There's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek there, it struck me. But then you go on to the whole notion of the moral argument. And you know, it's interesting to wonder how many regular meat eaters would cut the throat of the cow themselves, over a drain if they're wise, to carry away the liters of outpouring blood, disembowel it, clear out the yards and yards of feces-loaded intestines, hack off its limbs, saw away big hunks of its muscles. Yet the tens of thousands of daily slaughterings of animals are hidden from view, an industrial process without sentiment, electric saws whining all day long and severed corpses swinging up on huge meat hooks every minute, dead staring eyes and heads bristling with hairs falling from the necks as the saws slice through with an added momentary howl. It's a vision of hell to the unaccustomed gaze and an admonition to the conscience once grasped in its full meaning. How odd it is that we prosecute anyone who is cruel to an animal, even to a pig or a cow, yet no connection is made between that fact and what comes hot to the dinner table. All blood, guts, cruelty, injustice and health risk hidden beneath a veneer of succulence and a little gravy. So, very powerful stuff. One's not even suggesting that you might be advocating vegetarianism. my take here is that in that, although that's a slightly more florid description, that's very parallel to your question about asking somebody just coming out of a church to describe the elements of their faith. You're basically saying in both places, have you thought about this?
That's exactly right. You know, Bertrand Russell famously said, most people would rather die than think of most people do. And alas, this is the tragedy of humankind, that we have this wonderful gift, the gift of intelligence and a capacity for rational reflection, and people don't think, they don't connect the dots, they don't go beyond. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine who was Bishop of Oxford and perhaps should have been Archbishop of Canterbury in this country, a man called Richard Harris, a very gifted intellectual and a very kind good man. He and I did a program for the Radio 4 and the BBC called The Bishop and the Atheist. And we went together to a Church of England school to talk to the school about it being a church school, what it meant to them. And the headmistress of the school started off by saying, look, in this school we have not only Church of England people, we have a lot of other religious faiths as well. And we try to encourage them to have mutual respect and understanding and to live together collegially. And she put this point, as a point of pride, that this was a great ambition of the school. And I said to her, look, that is not anything to praise you for. That is the least we would expect from you. That is just your duty. So we're not going to, you're not super irrigating here. We expect that from you, and we're not going to applaud you for it. What we would applaud you for it is if for all these different faiths, you got them to think it right through to the end and challenge them on their beliefs and their understanding. Because I said, let's take some of these six lovely sixth form girls that they produced. There was a Muslim girl and a Catholic girl and I think a Church of England girl, and they found an atheist girl as well. So I said to the Muslim girl, well, they're all friends, these girls, by the way, all did their homework together and went home together in the afternoons. I said, what's going to happen to your friends when they die? Oh, well, she wanted to ... this one. And I said, no, come on. What does your faith say will happen to people who have rejected the teaching of the Prophet? Well, they're going to go to hell. So I said to the Catholic girl, Catholic doctrine says there is no salvation outside the church. No one comes to the Father but by me, says Jesus Christ. So what's going to happen to these other people who don't accept this, your Muslim friend, your atheist friend? Well, they're going to go to hell. And either all of them, what's going to happen to the atheist girl? Oh, well, she's going to hell. Okay, so she was outvoted by a lot of them. And Richard Harris and the headmistress of school said to me, what are you doing? You're stirring up trouble here. You're being divisive, and this is causing a problem. And I said, no, it isn't. This is getting them to think right the way to the end of what it is they take themselves to be committed to or think that they believe in. This is getting them to explore it in its full meaning. And if you don't do that, if you don't get people to think, if you don't challenge them to do that, then we're going to go on as we are with a whole lot of mystifications and obfuscations and half-thoughts and Chinese walls and people doing science one minute and go to church the next minute and never really addressing the question as to whether they're consistent or not. They might be, but let's have the argument and the demonstration that that's so. So it is a question of the rational life. And the word rational there is key. Ratio nil. Proportional. You proportion your beliefs, your commitments, your actions to the evidence you have for them, for the case you can make for them, always under the government of two principles. The first is that what you do, what you choose to do, what you think mustn't harm other people in their endeavor to do the same. And secondly, that if you meet counter evidence, or you meet a better argument, you yield to it, or you take it into account, or you adjust your own views accordingly. This idea that we live the reasoned, the reflective, the chosen, the empirically grounded life. Now, the fact is that sounds what all the critics of what I earlier called the Enlightenment Project would say, very desiccating. It's very reductive. It drains the world of its color and its poetry. Not at all. A rational, a proportional individual recognizes the need for joy, for ecstasy, for love, for the orgasm, for partying, for leisure, for relaxation, for hours in the sun. Of course, this is part of what a good and well-lived life includes. The health of everything, that the health of one's pleasures, as well as of one's mind and one's body. But it recognizes also that this is a constituent, a part of a well-integrated life. When people talk about living with integrity, they usually mean morally, they don't pinch the money in the till, but actually integrity means integration, and having a well-integrated life where the emotional aspects, leisure, self-education, commitment to one's one's work, responsibility to one's fellows in the world, all fit together, that one has an overall sense of what one is as a person and what one's doing in life on all these fronts. This is the reason, the considered life. It's not a Mr. Spock of Star Trek kind of coldly logical life. It's a life where the emotions have their full play. After all, Aristotle, one of the great, you know, sort of prophets of reason, said, for example, there is right anger. You can be angry about things in the right way, at the right time, over the right subject matter, and in the right kind of proportion. Now, anger is a powerful emotion and a powerfully motivating emotion over many matters. To be angry about injustice, to be angry about greed, to be angry about what the bankers have done to the world economy, to be angry about human rights violations in developing countries, is a justified kind of anger, and a good anger, because it motivates people to take action. So the reasoned life is not a cold, you know, passionless, icy kind of life, not at all. It's a rational life, a proportional life. But it means managing it, thinking about it. One of the great gifts of the Stoic philosophers of antiquity in the late ethical school of Stoicism, they taught a sense of mastery, of trying to make an integrated, reflective life which put all the pieces together in the right kind of way so that you could live most effectively. The simplest example, which we're all familiar with, is trying to stay healthy physically, because you stay healthy mentally if you do that kind of association. But it runs right across the board for the well-lived life. So the life of reason, get back to your original point, alas and alas, so few people really challenge themselves and really think through the ideas that they live by, the concepts under whose government they exist. And they should do it, not just as a one-off, but it should be a component of a well-lived life. Now, if you say this to people, they say, well, how do you think about things? I mean, do you go away and do this? And, you know, if you try that, nothing will come. And so you've got to point out to people that thinking is a process of reading and discussing and finding out what other people think and trying to make a case for something that you think. And then if more powerful arguments come, adjusting that case or giving it up or changing your view or starting again. You know, it's a process. Thinking is not just sitting under a tree and hoping that you're going to solve the problems of the universe. It's a process of engagement with the whole conversation that mankind has had with itself through history and now about the right, the good, the true, all the great questions in philosophy. But philosophy belongs to everybody, and everybody should be engaged. Everybody should be reading history, because that, as Thucydides told us, is the great philosophical teacher, really, the examples that we get from history about these things. But to think. You're dead right. People coming out of churches, people eating meat, people doing all the things that they normally do, they do it as if they were on automatic pilot.
If I pressed you and said, what is your, where would you align yourself? I mean, having read quite a number of your books now, I would have said you'd probably had a great fond spot for late Stoics, in fact, Epictetus and so on.
Yes, very much so. I mean, anybody can read these extremely accessible works, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, people know about that. Because Marcus Aurelius ends up on the bookshelves which have all the other woolly uplift, you know, the spiritual and the crystals and things, which is a great pity, because one reflected a little bit on the fact that he was a man living a very, very hard life on the northern frontier of the Roman Empire against very formidable enemies, sleeping on the ground or on a bench in his tent, and thinking about how to address this experience, how to manage himself, and writing down this little commonplace book. Really, self-adjuration, self-advice to self, so to speak. He was his own counsel, trying to take his own counsel. And what you get out of both these thinkers, and out of Epictetus, the slave, who always used to say to his pupils at the end of each day's instruction, tell me, how long will you delay to be wise? You know, how long before you really begin to put to work thinking about your own life? They both of them taught this, thinking about what we have no control over. We can't control the fact that eventually we're going to die, however successful we are in conquering aging, that earthquakes and tsunamis happen, that diseases happen, that people we care about, we may lose them. You know, with respect to these things, we must have courage. We've got to face life with courage. I'm reminded of the character Herzog in one of Saul Bellow's novels, where he's cracking up, but he says to himself, whatever happens to me, whether I live or die, let me do it with dignity, you know, the dignity of courage, face life of courage. Seems simple, but you know, if you lived it and genuinely did bravely confront all the things that you can't yourself control. And then with regard to those things you can master, your appetites, your fears, your anxieties, your laziness, your whatever it might be, your thoughtlessness, your anger, with respect to them, become their governor. School yourself to become their governor. This is a very powerful view. Now, of course, nobody can live like this, you know, except for the most magnificent example of a Stoic. But the effort to do it, the attempt, that is the thing which, you know, makes a life a good and worthwhile life.
I made the claim to Patricia Churchland the other day that this was actually a spectacular time for philosophy in the history of ideas, in the sense that although a lot of it is now does not stand up to the information that comes from neuroscience, it is such a wonderful body of information, as you've just said, that with some tweaks and the input from neuroscience, it becomes a much stronger edifice of thought. And do you agree with that?
Well, I do. I mean, I think there is a this point to be made, and I'm a tremendous fan and admirer of what's happening in the neurosciences. And the neurosciences, of course, are a very rich and exciting family of endeavors. There's not just, you know, neurology, there's not just neurophysiology.
One addendum, and I make that point because there's a number of books going to be coming out shortly. Sam Harris has a book coming out called The Moral Landscape, in which he uses neuroscience to inform the is-ought problem. Pat has a book coming out called Brain-Based Values. Steve Pink has a book coming out on evil, I think. Or violence. Mark Hauser has a book coming out on evil. So these are all scientists in the philosophical world.
Yes. So, which I think is terrific, and we're going to learn a huge amount from these things, and they're going to help to shift the sort of center of gravity in debate about these matters. Because among other things, what they do is they really do situate us where we belong, which is in the animal kingdom. I mean, we are animals, but we're very smart and self-reflective animals, and we can use facts about our nature, the fact, for example, that we have, you know, drives and desires and sexual appetites and need for food and shelter and need to belong to an in-group and so on. We have a lot of biological and sociobiological and neurological facts about us, which are going to be richly informative when we think about why we do what we do, why we react as we react, how we can govern some of those less desirable reactions to things, and so on. So it's going to be great.
However,
at the same time, however, I think that there is one point which we've got to hang on to as well, which is that in one important sense, mind is not brain. And I don't mean this in a dualistic or non-materialistic way. I mean, I think if somebody puts an ice pick through my head, I'm going to stop thinking. Okay, so in that sense, mind is brain. But mind is something which has to be understood in what philosophers would call a broad content way. That is, to understand the nature of a thought or a memory or what it is to have and apply a concept, you have to understand something more than just what is happening in that individual brain. You have to understand the social and natural context, the environment, of how a thought about something out there in the world is different from another thought about something different out there in the world, where reference to the social and natural environment of a head is ineliminable from a description of what's going on in the head. So I put the point in reviewing a book just recently that minds are produced by more than one brain, that is by the interaction of brains, by intercommunication, by education, by what Karl Popper called the third realm, that is the body of knowledge which accumulates and from which we all benefit and which we learn as our framework for thinking about things.
The social brain.
Yeah, the social brain in a way. So, you know, that has to be taken into account when we try to understand these very complex phenomena of the moral life and of ethical attitudes and reactions. And an extremely good point was made by Paul Bloom in a piece recently, which I quoted in this review I wrote, where he said, if you were, you know, too crude, as nobody is, but if you were too crude about the neurology stuff, you would think that human brains, for tens of thousands of years, have worked in a way which made them do X, Y, and Z, and that's why we do what we do, and that explains our morality. But the fact is that people living today in the Western world accept and embrace sexual diversity. You know, there are some people who are gay and some people who are not, and we want to respect people's orientations and not punish them for that. And this is a very, very big shift in moral attitudes over the last, half a century. It's not a matter of many centuries. And the fact that that can happen shows that our moral attitudes are not deterministically produced by something that is not out of the control of reflection and debate and conversation. And the fact that it is that our moral attitudes can change over time, that we can think differently about things, that we can give up capital punishment, that we can think differently about sexual morality and marriage and divorce, then all these are pretty recent changes in Western history, shows that this is not something rooted in non-reflective, non-conscious reflexes and attitudes. They're not hardwired.
Yeah. So, Paul, I don't know if you're referring to the same thing, but Paul had a piece recently called The Moral Life of Babies, and has been studying himself because his wife is Karen Wynn, of course, they work in these areas, and I will have a conversation with him at some point. But the fact that people are talking about the moral life of babies and the ontogeny of morality is very interesting at this point.
Because, of course, the fact is that there just is, you know, the central nervous system, but it's an evolved and a descended one, and it's one that is going to have a very, very great deal in common with all other central nervous systems on the planet, human and non-human. You know, just recently some work has been done on behavioural indications of pain in mice whose facial expressions mimic certain facial expressions in human beings. That kind of pain reaction, you can see it in the face of mice. But I mean, in all sorts of ways, we're going to learn a massive amount from the neurosciences about these things. My point really is just to say that information, what we learn from the neurosciences, has got to be plugged into a slightly bigger story, which is about the interconnection between different central nervous systems, not just a story about what happens in one.
Let's talk about, the fact that we're here in this place which the society itself, the Royal Society of London, not the Royal Society of the United Kingdom, Royal Society of London, which was a kind of an institution, a gathering of scholars, a society initially, which met in 1660 initially, to instantiate in some sense Bacon's vision, as in the New Atlantis of the Merchants of Light and so on. In this year of celebration of science here, I keep asking people to reflect on what President Obama said when he came into office in his inaugural address, and later at the National Academies when he spoke about his administration's desire to restore science to its rightful place. Given what we've just talked about, implicit in that, I gather, is a view that you have of the rightful place of science. I'd like to ask you what that is in your view.
Well, I think it's central. It's central to our education. I mean, it's not exclusive, that's true, but it's central. But people ought never to leave the educational process being scientifically illiterate. Now, you don't have to be a scientist to be scientifically literate, but to have an understanding of scientific method, of the accumulating body of knowledge which constitutes science, always, of course, the feasible knowledge could be revised by future experiment and discovery, of course, the open-mindedness, open-endedness, the unfinished character of the scientific enterprise is an important thing about science. The scientific mindset which accepts doubt and open-endedness and which is excited by the fact that there are more problems to solve is very different from the mindset that wants a neat, closed, finished story which has a creation and a moral code and a teleology at the end of it. So that's very, very different. Nobody, therefore, should come out of education without being scientifically literate. And that shows that science has to be at the center of education. And by extension, it has to be at the center of society, because we live in very, very highly technologized times. Almost everything that we do depends in the end on our knowledge of how to work with nature and how to adapt and benefit from our understanding of nature. So science, through its applications via technology, is important to our daily lives. we pick up a telephone, we get on an aeroplane, we get on a bus, we eat food which has been sanitized by scientific methods. I mean, we will not have many minutes in the day when our lives aren't shaped and touched by science. So it's important that science should be extremely well done. That means it has to be well funded, well researched. That means that the whole community, the whole ethos of science has to be maintained as a very rigorous, a very open, a very argumentative enterprise in our society, which is respected and accepted and paid for in the right kind of way. Not so that it becomes, you know, like a church or an institution where people can make decisions for themselves about these matters, but where it is, of course, answerable to the rest of society and other human beings through this process of self-criticism and examination, through peer review, through the skepticism of colleagues. You know, the wonderful thing about science as an epistemology is its self-correcting character, and that the fact that it is vigorously self-critical at its best. Of course, people get away with things, people falsify results, people want to win the Nobel Prize, people want to be first, people rush and hurry, dozens of people put their names to a paper so they can get published. You know, scientists are human beings as well. But almost alone of all human activities, it is the one which in the medium and long term does adjust itself, and does so because it's an open, anarchic, brawling community of people who dress really badly and who criticize one another and who are smart. And that's the beautiful thing about them. So I think it's very central to our lives as human beings. And by the way, it always has been. I mean, one can go right back through the millennia and think about people who were thinking, how do I get the water from the river to my field? How do I harness the energy of the wind? How do I, you know, all the technological fixes that have very ingeniously, you know, because we're an incredibly ingenious species. You only have to go to a museum of technology or any museum for that matter to see this fact, the way that people have thought about solving practical problems. But behind the practicalities and behind the technologies that people have constructed has been this scientific curiosity. And I always quote, the man who by tradition is nominated the father of philosophy, Thales of Miletus, who lived back in around about 585 BC. And the interesting thing about him is that he asked the question, what is the world made of? And he gave the answer, water. It's not a very convincing answer, but it's a very interesting answer because it was based on observation and it was based on reason. He looked around him, there's water everywhere. It's necessary for life, it's ubiquitous, it's in the sea and the rivers, it falls out of the sky, it's in my veins, it's in the sap of the tree, and it's the only thing he knew of. And by the way, it produces earth, as proved by the Nile and its silt. And moreover, it can take all three forms of solid, liquid and gas, only thing that he knew that could. So its ubiquity, necessity, metamorphic character, and that showed him that it had to be the ultimate stuff. You know, forget about strings and quarks and leptons, it's water, said Thales. Okay. So that was a really smart answer. And the beautiful thing about it is that it doesn't appeal to traditions or the gods who created everything or to ancient scriptures. It appealed to a belief that we can look, think, reason, try and work it out. And that is the essence of the scientific mindset, and that is why that mindset and the whole enterprise that's come out of it should be central. So when Obama said, let's give science its rightful place in society, yes, let's put it back as among those things at the center of all our endeavors, which are really important and which we really value, along with the arts, along with a rational process of self-government and discussing how we should comport ourselves. Yes, these things are very central too. But without science, they're going to be much less effective. And science, anyway, is humanity's greatest achievement. I say this as a lover of Renaissance art and of music and the rest of it, but all you have to do is pick up a popular book on physics or cosmology or something, and think about the achievement of the human intellect in those respects. It is the greatest monument of humanity ever.
As we sit in this building surrounded by portraits down there, historical portraits, there's Henry Oldenburg down there, first Secretary of the Royal Society. There's obviously the founders. There's Humphrey Davy on one of these floors. There's Newton here. There's Flamsteed and Halley and so on. Robert Boyle. If I give you a time token, allow you to go and travel and have conversations with anybody from history, and I know that you've written about artists as well, Hazlitt and so on. Who would you like to sit down, have dinner with, and ask them some questions?
Well, I would like to have a dinner party, if I may, because I'd like to get quite a collection of people.
Not too expensive.
And it would pretty quickly become difficult to not have a banquet, you know, in the Whitehall Banqueting House, because of all the people that one would love to meet and talk to. Before I come up with the answer, you mentioned the very first person you mentioned, there was Oldenburg. You think of the name, it has a Dutch ring to it. Of course, the founding of the Royal Society in 1660 came off the back of quite a lot of discussion and debate and European contacts among scientists or natural philosophers, as they thought themselves, in the decades that preceded it. In a way, you can think of the 1660 as being another important date in the history of the 17th century. 1632, Galileo, 1600, when Giordano Bruno was burned to death in Rome, partly because he accepted the Copernican view. But in the 1620s, in the great libertine movement in Paris, which, by the way, didn't mean people having orgies, it meant people, free thinkers, thinking outside the religious box, and they got the name libertine for that reason. And there was a group of them in Paris in the 1620s, trying to collect what people had understood and learned from others in Europe, and to advance understanding of mathematics and the physical sciences. It's a very, very exciting century, and there are lots of people in it, like father and son Huygens, for example, Mersenne, who was a sort of clearing house. He was the World Wide Web of his day.
Gilbert doing magnetism.
Exactly, and Harvey. I mean, the place is rich in people who made such giant strides in so many frontier aspects of our understanding of the natural world, that if you did manage to gather them together into one room, it would have to be a pretty big room. And I would like to talk not just to the great names. I'd just love to meet Newton, obviously, and I'd love to meet the younger Huygens. I'd love to meet Descartes. I'd love to meet Galileo. But it's not just the great names of the century. It's the fact that these great names are the peaks of a pretty extensive mountain range. And the mountain range is people who were doing experiments, people who were working away behind the scenes, people who were asking questions. When the Royal Society was set up, people wrote in with problems, and the technicians, and not the grandees, were set to work to try and solve these problems. And it was that the sense that the mind of man was free to ask, to inquire, to search, to seek, without preconceptions. Now, this is the important point: without preconceptions. The church had shot its bolt with Galileo, I think, by the mid-century, the 17th century. It no longer claimed authority over research, authority over the truth. You have to remember that in the first half of the 17th century, the Church of Rome, at least, was saying to people, Scripture comes first. 102nd Psalm says, He hath fixed the foundations of the earth that it might not be moved forever, so the planet doesn't move. And Scripture says so, and you're in trouble if you disagree. Well, by the end of the century, it was no longer possible for the church to control investigations of that kind. When people looked at Halley's Comet and the rest, that they weren't thinking in terms of portents and magic. They were thinking in terms of an order of nature that could be understood, subsumed under laws, described, predicted, measured, and brought into a self-consistent pattern. And that is a massive intellectual change of view. And it's because of these brilliant men and the fact that they were free to think and inquire without preconceptions. And that, I think, is an important point.
State of education. We've been working with the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, of which I'm a part at UCSD, and looking also, discussing with the XPRIZE Foundation, looking at the possibility of an incentive-based innovative prize in education, so that people would actually come up with different systems, put them all in competition, see what they came out of it. Largely because of the state of education is in such flux, certainly in the United States. Do you have any thoughts about the state of education at this point, specifically science education, if you want?
There is a great deal of concern about education, especially at the primary and secondary levels, less so, I think, at the tertiary level. There, the problem, universities and research institutions, is perennially a problem of funding. But at the primary and secondary levels, there's been a lot of concern over the last half century and more, I think since maybe the mid-20th century, for the following reason, that in a highly technologized, highly complex, finance-centered world order, it's of great importance that economies should have educated and adaptable and flexible and retrainable people who have a good understanding of technicality, whether it's economic technicality or technological technicality. And so our education systems have been trying to produce, you know, cohorts of people capable of getting their hands on the levers of all these different machines that society now complicatedly involves. And the anxieties that people have relate to the fact that we're still getting large, over significant proportions of people coming out of the secondary education system who range from the functionally illiterate to the not very well informed and not very interested and so on. So there is a sort of cliche view that education in the West is failing, that it's not doing what we want it to do and what we need it to do. Now, there are aspects of this picture which are right and aspects of this picture which are wrong. And I think it's terribly important to notice two things. Firstly, that teaching professions, when you go to look at primary and secondary school teachers in most Western countries, they do an extraordinary job. I mean, it's a heck of a hard job. I, as a university teacher, would not want to have the sheer level of demand that a secondary school teacher has. I mean, they've got to prepare half a dozen lessons for every day. They've got to mark, you know, any number of books. They've got to think about imaginative ways of getting their students engaged. They've got to deal with pastoral concerns. They've got to discipline their students, try and keep some kind of order. And, there are lots of different skills that a teacher needs to have to be able to do all these things. It's a very different thing controlling a group of people from making them interested in, let us say, physics. So I have immense admiration for teachers, and I think that a lot of effort is put into trying to teach imaginatively, teach accessibly, attract and inspire students to do what's necessary in education, which is to do the work themselves. Nobody can do it for you, nobody can do your learning and thinking and understanding. In the end, each individual has to do it for themselves. And so the educational process has to get people into the position where they do that, and that's inspiration, absolutely. So a lot of good is done. A lot of thinking is done about how to organize this, new, imaginative, innovative ways of presenting subjects to school children. So one shouldn't think that anybody out there is complacent or that we've slipped back. Our problem is the human material. I mean, years and years and years ago, Winston Churchill wrote a memoir of his early life called, not unsurprisingly, My Early Life. And he was a hopelessly inadequate schoolboy at Harrow School. Never managed to get out of the first form, never learned anything at all. Couldn't get out of the first form even until he was 18. And he, in this memoir, he said, we should teach children to read and write, and then we should send them out into the world and they can go and work in the fields or do whatever they want to do. And those among them who want to learn will pretty soon come back. And then they will learn far faster or more efficiently and more profoundly than if we try and force it on them. And it may be, I mean, I'm not advocating this as a system, child labor and all that, I'm not advocating that, but it does make a point that we have a sausage machine attitude towards education. You know, all the kids go in at 5 or 6 and then they plod through the stages and they all come out again at 18, go off to college and all come out again at 21. And maybe the big 30%, 40% of kids who don't really achieve very highly at any of these levels, maybe that way of doing things is just wrong. Maybe we need a much more diverse, even more imaginative approach to education and think of lots of different solutions to get people inspired and to get them in. What those are, you know, we need to be encouraging and enabling the specialists and those with a passion for these things to do all that, to innovate. But in the end, we have to remember also that education is not just for foot soldiers in the economic struggle. It's about a whole of life. Aristotle said, we educate ourselves so that we can make a noble use of our leisure. Now, that is not an attitude that anybody would buy today. Today, you've got to be able to read and write, you've got to be able to function at the till in a supermarket, or, you know, get a job in a factory, or get a job as a clerk. And it's all about the 8 hours a day that you've got to be at work, and not the 16 hours a day when you're relating to other human beings and reading books and going to the theatre and the cinema and so on. And education has to be complete. It's got to be able to produce a complete individual. And it ties into all sorts of other concerns too. We think about democracy. We think about turnouts in democracies. We think about the sort of choices that people make in our Western political arrangements. Democracy only really works with an educated and reflective electorate. And we don't have, we haven't quite achieved the sort of level of education and reflection in the general population as a whole, which would be a bit closer to the ideal for this thing. To quote Churchill again, he famously said, democracies are the least bad of all systems, but he also said, the most powerful argument against democracy is 5 minutes with any voter. And you can sort of see his point, that the reason why people make the choices they do politically and vote as they do tends to be, and this is a theme that's come up again and again in our conversation, that people are insufficiently thoughtful, insufficiently reflective. And to be thoughtful and reflective, you've got to be, to some extent, educated. And educated means something more than just being trained for a job.
We have to vacate this place very shortly because they're getting ready for a celebration of the centennial of Dorothy Hodgkin, a wonderful scientist. But let me ask you very briefly for one closing remark. I think I may have asked you this before last time. Let's see if your views have changed. What are you optimistic about?
Well, I'm optimistic about the world, actually, and about humankind in the world, because I think that even though those who are really committed to trying to address our problems, I'm not going to say solve our problems, because, you know, being human and being a resident on this planet is a work in progress. There are always going to be new problems. Some of our solutions will create those problems. But there is an endeavor here, which is an endeavor towards the good. And by that I mean a more flourishing, a more peaceful, a more collegial world in which we transcend the artificial boundaries between people posed by religion and politics and ethnicity and the like, and that we all recognize that the old cliche about being one family is actually profoundly true, and we've got to pull together and make use of all our resources of mind and of material to make the world a better place. This is not a perfectibilist project. This is not an assault on utopia. This is the belief that incrementally, by serious and well-intentioned endeavor, we can make things better in lots and lots of respects, even though we're always going to have problems to face. I say to people, each one of us in the Western world today lives the life that 400 years ago was only possible for the wealthiest of aristocrats. We now have the rule of law in our Western democracies. 3 or 4 centuries ago, most of us, the great majority of us, would have been under the arbitrary rule of potentates and priests and princes. This is progress for me. This shows that by thinking about things and by being able to control both the social and the natural realms to our advantage a little bit more, we can make progress. And so I believe that if we can survive this little bottleneck now, because, you know, Theodore Adorno quite rightly said, we've got a lot cleverer than our ancestors, but no wiser than they, because this is proved by the fact that we developed the spear into the guided missile. Now, that wasn't such good thinking. And so we're at a dangerous impasse at the moment. But if we can get through this and get a sort of different and more inclusive mindset, then there's everything to be optimistic about.
A place for scientific meliorists.
Yes, absolutely.
Anthony Grayling, thanks very much.
Great pleasure.